So I'll start off with a question for all three panelists, and you can order it, you can respond in any order you wish, but I guess the first question would be, should all captives, including pure captives, be considered for the same regulatory treatment? And I'd be interested in hearing comments on that particular item.
No. I think as regulators, we need to understand the purpose of the captive and why that captive is being set up. But we don't think that it makes a lot of sense to treat every captive the same.
I guess I'll go second. I'll agree with Commissioner Gearhart and say no. But I think it's kind of a definitional issue. When you talk about a pure captive, as Professor Hoyt mentioned, what you historically were talking about is a entity that was formed to basically self-insure the risk of a third party or of a company, and not third-party risk. And one of the issues that we get into with respect to the XXX, AXXX, and the variable annuity captives is that they're insurer-owned captives. And I don't consider that to be a pure captive, because the insurer-owned captive is basically aggregating risk of not only its own risk, but really the risk of the policyholders and the ceding company, and reinsuring that risk. So that's different than a traditional definition of a pure captive.
And I guess I'll just chime in and say, not only should there be a difference between pure captives and insurance company-owned captives, but even amongst different kinds of insurance company captives, we're sort of finding the regulation needs to sort of deal with the problem at hand. And so we've ended up with sort of two different paths for XXX, AXXX type captives versus the VA captives. And so it's important to understand the underlying business issues that caused the captives in the first place, and then develop regulatory solutions that, you know, keep solvency in mind and conservatism in mind, but at the same time help the companies be able to sell business in particular lines of business that meet social needs.
Thank you. And I think, you know, part of at least what I've seen, I mean, you know, the captives have just evolved, and we're not even calling them captives in many of the states now. They're called special purpose vehicles, special purpose reinsurers, and I think that's a positive move. I think, you know, we're somewhat tainting some of the, you know, pure captives and association type captives, other captives that have been utilized without issue for years, by throwing everything in that captive bucket. So I think it's actually good that we are now differentiating them. And as Paul said, you know, if we address the regulatory issues that are causing the formation of these entities, we shouldn't have any problem going forward. I'll address this next question to Commissioner Gearhart. And Nick, how would you say regulators assess risk from a captive reinsurer at the entity and group level, and how do they really assess this, address this risk?
Well, I'll speak to this how we do it in Iowa. We have a little bit of a unique law, and we call these limited purpose subsidiaries, so another term that we try to use to distinguish these. And our I say it's unique. It's been around for about 5 years. The law requires the carrier to be domiciled in the state of Iowa. All of our financials are public, so you can go to our website and pull the financials down for these, which ends up getting you in the paper once in a while. And so that's there. But also, every 2 years, we do an actuarial test and assessment of those transactions. And from my perspective, you know, they've worked pretty well. The reason I like the fact that they're Iowa domiciled carriers, I have the same analyst on that subsidiary, that limited purpose subsidiary, that's also on the entity. And that's pretty powerful as a regulator, because we see through the entire transaction. I think the folks at AM Best mentioned, you know, they've been looking at it sort of the same way through those arrangements with the different carriers. But as a regulator, we look at that the same way as well. Also, from our perspective, looking at the fact that same analyst is looking through that, we also have the tool of ORSA now, so that analyst working with senior examiners at the division now has ORSA at his or her disposal. If there's a carrier that's an ORSA filer, and I believe every carrier that has an LPS in Iowa is an ORSA filer, so those folks would have ORSA to review as well. But I think the key element really is, a key element is that independent analysis. So when we look at their assumptions and we have that key independent analysis done, in addition to the analysis my team's doing, checking the assumptions that that carrier used, that's a pretty powerful oversight tool. We also review the disclosures from the annual statement, and we would follow up with that carrier if we have any questions from that. And finally, as far as the group, we would request and review insurer profile summaries to make sure that we understand the risks of that company and certainly the captive or LPS that's within it. So we have a pretty thorough structure that was created in code about 5 years ago, signed by the governor, obviously, and we feel that it works pretty well for the carriers in Iowa that are doing that.
Thank you, Nick. Did you want to
comment on that?
Sure.
I think that was a wonderful description of how a single state can actually address this issue and try to address this issue effectively. As Director Torti, or Commissioner Superintendent Torti, I guess it is, Joe, okay, as Joe mentioned earlier, one of the issues, though, that we had to address when dealing with this issue is that not always was the reinsurer regulated by the same state as a ceding company, and not always was there the amount of coordination and also transparency as described by Commissioner Gerhart. And so the rule really had to address that issue. And it's interesting, in the context of a recent supervisory college meeting that I attended, the issue came up of whether or not a affiliated reinsurer was appropriately addressing the risk that was reinsuring and had sufficient assets to basically address that risk. And what one of the European regulators had actually done was something that I think the person from AM Best mentioned. They collapsed the entire transaction to basically do a proper assessment of whether or not there were sufficient assets to basically address the risk. Since it was a European perspective, they looked at the economic risk, a little bit different how we would look at it. But it's another technique that you can do if you have sufficient transparency and information to assess the risk.
So great comments, thank you. Next one is addressed to all of the panelists, and I just touched on accreditation, and assuming accreditation scopes in life, variable annuity, and long-term care, should other types of captive reinsurance be considered for accreditation purposes also, not just those three types?
Well, I'll go ahead and try to address this first, since I'll probably be different than everybody else up here. I've always thought that addressing captives through the accreditation program, having the insurance company rules apply to the captives themselves was a stopgap measure at best, because of the fact that you could have offshore captives that weren't subject to those rules. And I think Neil Rector mentioned that earlier today, that when we were looking at what do we do with XXXA, XXX captives, we very quickly decided that trying to regulate the captive itself, or the special purpose insurer, whatever framework you want to call it, was not a full solution. And I actually think that we've already adopted a pretty good solution, and Joe, you mentioned it earlier in your slides, and that is the fact that we now have, as part of the Part B accreditation standards, the rules for reviewing captive transactions, and so that the ceding company's regulator has a set of rules to follow to make sure that that the transaction is appropriate, or else they shouldn't be giving reinsurance reserve credit for it. And And much like the XXX solution, where all the regulation is on the reinsurance credit itself, I actually think that's the most effective way to handle not only XXX long-term care and VA, but any types of these type of arrangements that you may want to consider.
Thank you, Paul. Did Nick or John want to comment?
In talking to my staff about this issue and thinking it through it myself, we seem to understand the logic is that, the ceding insurers here to go into this accreditation is that the business is written in other states. And so I go back to kind of my comment on number one. I think we want to look at the captives and the purposes and these vehicles a little bit uniquely in terms of how they are set up. I'd have some real reservations throwing every captive into an accreditation process. I disagree slightly with Paul that I think there are some, in looking ahead at what the F committee is doing on accreditation, I think there's some value to that on some of these transactions, but I would have a real hesitancy to throw all captives into an accreditation.
I would agree with that. I don't think it's necessary to throw all captives into the accreditation standard. I think that the focus, however, so far has been trying to basically limit that rule to what I think Joe called multi-state risks. And really, this is, I think, one of the areas where when you say captive, you lose perspective, because we're not talking about all captives. We're talking about primarily captives that basically are insurer-owned captives, where the captive is part of the insurance group and ceding a related risk. And under those circumstances, where you're not really necessarily diversifying your risk, if what the insurer-owned captive is reinsuring is really a multi-state risk and not its own risk, then I think that it is appropriate to bring the requirements related to the regulation of that reinsurer within the accreditation standards.
Thank you. All valid comments. I think, again, part of the problem is the whole captive bucket that we're utilizing here. We can't, I guess, create a situation where we say, okay, captives aren't included in accreditation, and then use that to avoid applying uniform requirements. So again, that's why I've been concentrating on multi-state insurer as the guideline. Pure captive, it makes no sense to include that in accreditation or several, and I'm no expert on captives, despite what people say. I'm not an expert on the true captives, XXX, maybe, but not the others. So there are certainly tons of captives out there that should not be part of the accreditation program. So I'll jump to the next, and maybe Paul, you could start with this, and I think John may want to add something to it. But what impact do you see AG 48 having on the availability and pricing of life and annuity products, and what about the impact of PBR?
Well, of course, the first thing is AG 48 won't have any impact on annuity products, so that's the easy question. For various reasons, I can't go to companies and say, what are you going to do with your prices? That would sort of have some antitrust implications. But I will say that the PBR requirements, the VM20 requirements, are more conservative than many of the older captive, XXX captive arrangements had used. And so companies are going to have an increased cost of capital for backing that business. And that increased cost of capital has to come from somewhere. Companies may choose to raise their prices. They may choose to try to find other sources of capital that might be similar in price as some of the letters of credit and alternate funding mechanisms that have been used behind captives. Certainly, the insurance industry is a very competitive industry, and companies will do everything they can to keep their products affordable. But I think it would be probably naive to say that it wouldn't have any impact at all.
Thank you. John, did you want to add to that?
Well, I think what Paul's trying to say is that it probably will have an impact. And that actually in the discussions of that we had with respect to AG 48, I mean, the point was made that the likely impact would be an increase in premiums. And one of the criticisms that was voiced is we hadn't looked as carefully as we should have at what that increase in premium might be and what that impact on policyholders might be. And from my perspective, I think one of the things that as a regulator we really have to deal with is, you know, what an insurance company is selling is not an automobile. It's not a widget where, you know, you get something in exchange for the premiums that you're paying, the price of the product. What you're getting is a promise to pay in the future. You're basically getting a piece of paper that that describes that promise to pay. And as regulators, what our job to do is to make sure that that promise to pay in the future, based on whatever fortuitous event is in that contract, can be satisfied. So if that requires a slightly higher premium to ensure that promise will be fulfilled, then that's appropriate. It's just like, it would be like saying if you were buying a car, you know, well, if you didn't include an engine in the car, obviously the car would be a lot cheaper. Should we sell that car? I don't think that would really achieve the purpose of buying a car without an engine. Similarly, if you basically sell a product with a long-term horizon on the ability to pay, if you're not appropriately pricing that product so that the insurer is going to be around to make that payment, then you're basically not doing any service to the policyholder by selling a cheaper product.
I'll probably try to say what John did a little bit differently, because I'll screw it up here. I'm not going to be as eloquent as John was there, but I was very sensitive to the price issue, because I had carriers come in and talk a lot about prices going up, and I heard ranges from 12% to 30%, I think, was the highest one I heard on. And just stepping back and thinking about, you know, part of my role is making sure that there is a vibrant market for life insurance products. And also in my background in the industry, I know how hard it is, you know, to price it. If you think about the industry, you don't know your cost of goods sold. If you, you know, you buy that car, that manufacturer knows their cost of goods sold. The insurers really don't know their cost of goods sold. So we want to be safe and secure. We want to make sure we have a strong solvency framework to make sure those promises can be paid. I think that's part of our job. But I also want to make sure the market's vibrant. I think we're at a 50-plus year low of the take-up of life insurance. And if you study millennials, they're more likely to buy insurance for their iPhone than their life. So we want to make product available, but we have to be smart that we can't, do that to the detriment of the solvency framework. So I think the Rector framework, and I give Neil a lot of credit too, I think that got us to a good spot.
Thank you. That has been a very difficult topic to address. I mean, I have a teenage son, and I'd like to be paying less than $4,000 a year for auto insurance, but, you know, the risk is that, so. Move on to the next question. What do you think the impact with the implementation of PBR will have on the formation of new captive reinsurers? I know I've been very vocal about, you know, once PBR is implemented, we won't need captives anymore. And I know the industry is, you know, has been hedging a bit on that and making statements on that. But I still believe that the need for captives will go away, but I'd love to hear the discussion.
So I'll go ahead and hedge again. but I think it's somewhat the wrong question at the end of the day, and Neil Rector went into this a little bit earlier, and that is, will it really matter if there are captives that are reinsuring XXX, AXXX business? It'll no longer be called that anymore. It'll be term and ULSG business, because those regulations won't be in place. When the standards are the same, regardless of whether the business is reinsured into a captive reinsurer or not. So if we've done our job appropriately here and we've set the requirement for the hard assets at the exact same level for a captive transaction or no captive transaction, then the impetus for having a captive will no longer be reserve financing. However, as some other folks have pointed out, there could be other reasons, risk aggregation, tax reasons, you know, any number of reasons where captives might be a good risk mechanism. And we shouldn't sort of lose sight of the fact that that's a good thing. But as far as risk financing goes, I don't see why anybody would continue with those types of transactions.
Thank you, Paul. Anyone else?
I'd come to a slightly different conclusion. I think the issue really is risk financing. And so captives will continue to exist if there's a mechanism that can be developed that would allow for financing of that risk and financing of that capital cost at a lower cost than the group can provide, or internally, as long as under the new rules that that vehicle is basically supported by primary assets. So I don't think it's going to eliminate the creativity of the lawyers and the investment bankers in the audience to develop these sort of vehicles. And as long as the financial markets can provide a product at a lower cost, and I think they'll still be around.
Joe, I agree with John there, and I think at the end of the day, the intent of the Rector framework was to eliminate or certainly mitigate the use of these captives. And I think PBR is the answer. And like you mentioned in your presentation, we don't have that PBR answer for the variable annuity issue. We're working on that. But I also want to remind folks that these are legal entities, and there may be reasons that I'm not aware of that something could come up down the road, and we'll have to look at crossing that bridge at a later date. But I think, assuming we got this right, I think the need is certainly mitigated greatly.
Thank you. And part of what I've looked at when I've looked at these transactions, it's that we spend, we're here now. We're at the NEIC. We spend months or years at times, and with PBR, I think it's been, 12 years, 13 years, working on it. And we're coming up with the solution. We're saying this is what the reserves should be. This is what conservatism should be built in. And then, at the end of the day, no one really pays too much attention because, we can come up with a workaround for that. So that's what we're, what I'd like to see us avoid in implementing PBR, that we don't build so much conservatism into PBR that it really, becomes another issue with the industry having to finance those reserves. And I think we're well on our way to going down that path. But yes, I do recognize there could be other aggregation reasons or other reasons why you might want to form a captive, but at least that doesn't, it's sort of, what we really can't, don't want to see is, we worked on this solution and everyone's working on a way to circumvent the solution that we came up with. So,
but Joe, I think this goes back to the other project at E Committee too, right? I mean, trying to address these more proactively.
Right, exactly. And, we have to keep, a lot of what helped us through the financial crisis is the conservatism that's built into our entire regulatory framework, our solvency framework. So we can't completely eliminate the conservatism that's built in, but we have to at the same time address the cost of products to policyholders. We can't just blindly say, you can't have any risk, and we can price this product as high as necessary. So. Let's jump to the next question. Next question was worded a little strangely, but it was, what happens if captive reinsurers do not comply with the regulatory framework? And when I looked at that, I said to the panelists, I'm going to change that to what happens if ceding insurers do not comply with the regulatory framework, because that's really what we mean. But I guess, you know, if we do, you know, apply the accreditation standards, then it could be, you know, what happens if captive reinsurers don't comply. So let's answer that, I guess, either way. What happens if a captive reinsurer doesn't comply with the regulatory framework if we implement it as an accreditation standard? What happens if ceding insurers do not comply with the AG 48 framework or the new model law?
Oh, I think they will. So, you know, I guess my answer is I think that's interesting hypothetical, but, you know, in our state, we're going to uphold the law. And I guess one of the issues is they may not get credit for that session. So, you know, at the end of the day, I don't really see that as a real issue.
Well, with respect to the model regulation, I think that's still work in progress. So we really don't know. I can tell you what there are four options that we're considering, and I'll go into those real quickly. The first option that I think the reinsurance task force is considering is if the ceding company enters into a reinsurance agreement with a captive affiliate, and there's insufficient primary assets to support the AMR, one option is that they receive no credit for that transaction. That's a very significant response, and it basically is intended to give a very clear message that one should not be entering into those sort of transactions. The other option is basically to recognize reduce the reinsurance credit to the extent of the deficit in the primary assets. And so you would, under that scenario, if you had a $100 million obligation that was reinsured and the AMR was $100 million, but you only had $90 million in primary assets, you would have a surplus hit of $10 million. Another one is proportionality, because under that scenario, you're under the second scenario, you're still getting full credit for your other assets. The other option that we're looking at is a proportionality type concept, where if you had a 10% shortfall in your primary assets, then you would have a 10% reduction in credit for both the primary assets and the other assets. And the last is kind of a little bit more severe, similar to the first, and that is if you had a shortfall in the primary assets, you would get no credit for the other assets, but you would still get credit to the extent that you had primary assets. So those are the options that are currently under consideration, and I think trying to make a decision on which of those options is the right solution is one of the things that we're going to be spending more time taking into consideration, and why we're unlikely to get the regulation finalized during this meeting.
Paul, did you want to add?
One thing that nobody addressed, so I'll throw it in, is the other question of what happens to the captive. At least on the XXX framework, because of the recent changes in the accreditation rules, if there's not compliance with the framework, then the captive is then subject to what I'll call the standard insurance laws that are covered under Part A and Part B of the accreditation program. So at least on those types of transactions, there is an impact on the captive if the framework's not followed as well.
That's pretty interesting, and that, you know, that would be a huge change. There's no way the captive could comply with the traditional statutes in that case. So there would be a problem, I guess, with the accreditation of the state that happened to have that entity. So, and that's the whole point of the accreditation program at the end of the day. So the ripple effect is where we end up. As far as I just want to add to what John said about the the model regulation, there's some discussion regarding what the charge was to the drafting group that got it, because you know PBR implementation, when we looked at this, we said, well, we're opening up a can of worms when we open up the credit for reinsurance model, so everyone's going to try to change everything once we open up the credit for reinsurance model. So we tried to be very narrow and say, well, AG 48 is what we want to implement the requirements of AG 48 in a model reg and implement a change to the model law that will get us to allow us to make those changes to the model regulation. So there's some discussion on, you know, whether we should be going down the four option road at this point in time, or whether we should just be considering implementing exactly what's in AG 48. So I'm sure that discussion will also continue.